You're listening to Life and Letters of Paul, Lesson 2. These online lectures and study guides have been created to provide listeners all over the world the opportunity to receive theological resources online for free. Gifts received from supporters like you help us continue this exciting work. Please partner with us so that millions all over the world can continue to receive and share in the life-changing message of the gospel. Click on the Give Now button on our homepage. That's worldwide-classroom.com. Thanks for your support.
Okay, let's move to the point of the general theological characteristics in the book of Acts. A lot of discussion has happened on this particular point, and I want to present what I would consider to be the most significant interest and line that we find in the book of Acts, drawn from the purpose statement that I have just given to you. Namely, that the book of Acts brings to conclusion the salvation purpose begun with Christ. The book of Acts brings to conclusion the salvation purpose begun with Christ in the gospel. The term that is very significant here is that of salvation history. Some critical scholars consider Luke Acts, the writer of Acts, to be the inventor of salvation history, and I have great problems with that kind of a statement. I believe that Luke understood a basic biblical principle, that of salvation history. What I have described to you in the first lecture will become a little more concrete here, namely that God in His mercy chooses to reveal Himself in history. So I could really add a little word here, salvation in history. It is not a concept of thought. It's not a body of truth to be meditated upon, but it is that God acts in history, that He actually lives, works through history, and reveals His truth. This is what is meant by salvation history, and the book of Acts is particularly strong here to show that there is a salvation historical continuity. And I'm going to add that one word, salvation historical continuity. The book of Acts shows that God continues to work in history. God continues to intervene in history. And that is part of the reason why no other author in the New Testament makes so many references to general history as Luke does. He is very concerned to place that which occurs with Jesus and that which occurs with the early Messianic Church in the setting of generally known history. Here we find references to Gallio. Here we find references to Gamaliel. Here we find references to Felix and Festus, all known figures in the ancient Roman world. You can read up on them from Josephus, the Jewish historian, Tacitus, and other Roman, Latin historians who speak about these figures. So we see that Luke, more than any other author, says, this is not something happening in a quiet corner. This is happening on the plane of generally known history. Paul appealed to Caesar. Who was Caesar when he appealed to Caesar? Nero, Emperor Nero, a very benign, friendly person, wasn't he? Ruthless emperor, especially towards the latter years, the first major persecutor of Christians in Rome, horrific deeds that he committed, most likely in 64 AD, by crucifying Christians upside down in Rome, making them responsible for the fire that had broken out, most likely on his instigation. So, the setting of salvation is in history, salvation in history. And so this is a very important character, a theological character, in the book of Acts, that you do not have God's truth God's work somehow suspended in midair, kind of this surreal, half-real image out there, detached from the realities and the constraints and the challenges of real life. No? Completely connected. That's why some theologians say theology and history is indivisible, particularly in the book of Acts. If you try to cut through, it is like cutting through a braid of hair. You split up the whole thing. You cannot divide the intertwining of God's work, God's speaking, God's action in history. You cannot divide it. It is intertwined, it's connected. It is that God speaks in and through history His eternal word, and He pursues His eternal purposes in and through history. Obviously, this is a supreme philosophical challenge. To have the eternal mixed with the temporal, to have the absolute mixed with the relative, is an enormous challenge. And ever since the Enlightenment, the concept of salvation history has been a greatly debated concept. To some people, that simple term, salvation history, is a contradiction in terms. You cannot have salvation and history. Either you need to lift history from the known, empirically known world into some kind of a sacred history, which some people have done, or you completely instrumentalize salvation into real history as projections of human beings of what they would like to see about salvation. So either history becomes unreal or salvation. But to have salvation in history, both real, both true, both binding, both strong, is nearly too much. In Germany we say too tough of a tobacco to smoke. Because it's just mind-boggling that you would have this. However, the incarnation of Christ, where the eternal is connected with the temporal, where the absolute enters the relative, is exactly that point that philosophically answers that nearly impossible question of bringing those two together. So salvation is something unique and something amazing, and the book of Acts makes no excuse, confronts face to face, that challenge and says, God is acting in history. I'll name to you Gallio, and I'll name to you Pilate. I'll give you the figures that you know, the coordination system that you are acquainted with, and in that coordination system of history, I will show you the work of God. So that is perhaps the single most important theological characteristic in the book of Acts, beyond its purpose that I have just stated, that there is this salvation historical continuity. And again, this spells hope for us. Because if God works in history, we are connected. We are connected with that history. And if God can intervene in history of 2,000 years ago, He has access to our coordination system. And you see, that is the strange aspect that happens in some people's theology, that they deny that God actually can work in human history, and therefore deny that God can work real salvation now. So your theology has great consequences. If you buy in to some kind of a teaching that salvation is not real, or the history is kind of a spiritual history, but it's really not connected with our known history, you have sold out to a philosophy, to a way of thinking that robs you of the impact and the reality of the gospel now. Either you have some kind of illusionary salvation, or you have some kind of illusionary history. So the challenge is great, and the book you're reading by Marshall takes these points very seriously. Again, I agree with a lot of what Marshall is saying, because he's concerned to show that Luke, in the book of Acts, describes salvation in history. Real salvation, real history. Real intervention of God. which I have described to you as necessary, a necessary element of salvation, but real history as well. It's fascinating then to study the Book of Acts as a historical document, and we have some wonderful old scholars like Ramsey and others who have studied the Book of Acts, and to see how does it function, how does it quote-unquote perform as a historical document. Most recently, Colleen Hamer has taken this process up. And Colleen Hamer wouldn't be that concerned about the salvation aspect of the Book of Acts, but in history aspect. And he simply, as a bachelor, a wonderful scholar, has gone through thousands and thousands of inscriptions, papyri, other evidence from the ancient world to see how does Luke perform just as a historian. No theological questions asked primarily, just how does he perform? And he comes up with the verdict that he performs incredibly refined, to the point that he uses the terminology of the region he describes that is operating in that time. And somehow it seems like Luke ran out of steam when he comes to the island of Malta. Because there he says the first of the island. You know, you can just say the first of the United States, because you don't know how to call president, you know, you just don't know that word, so you just say the first of that nation. Well, an archaeological research has shown that that was the title, that was the way that person there was referred to. So he is using technical terminology, although it sounds like he was running out of steam. Another little things, I'm getting a little carried away, but at least I'm aware of it. Just to illustrate this performance on the historical side, critics have said it's impossible that a man under house arrest, being virtually a prisoner on a ship, going from Caesarea Philippi to Rome, could speak up. You know, Paul says a lot of things on the ship, and it just doesn't sound right. I mean, he is somebody who is bound. He's a prisoner. He has to be quiet, you know. And here he says, do this, don't do that, and follow this. It just sounds like the person that Luke wants to portray as the hero of the story just continues blindly through this story, even though he should be quiet if it were a historic account. Well, a particular sea law has been discovered that is operating at the time of the New Testament. And that stipulates the following. Normally, prisoners are to be quiet. However, if the ship is in danger, these laws will be temporarily suspended. Everybody's word counts. All the council, regardless of their social status, has to be taken in. A decision has to be reached, and they have to act in unison. Why? Survival. You cannot have division on the ship when your ship is about going overboard. So you must have unity, and therefore you suspend the normal social laws and completely work in democracy. Anybody's word, anybody's counsel will be sought, and so that makes perfect sense. So, again, you see that the description seems to be ahistorical until you find out what are the particularities of the historical situation, and you find out it's amazing. It's just amazing how well Luke performs, quote-unquote, as a historian. But you see that he always comes back to the fact that it is God who is working in this history. So, again, it's just the setting, it's just the situation, but we don't want to overemphasize that situation, but it's so comforting because that's the situation we're in. That's the situation you and I are living in. Yes, sir. Yes. Yes. The question is, how about the speeches in Acts? Are they historical? Luke was not there, at least in the first part of Acts. There's no indication that Luke was there. I will come to the speeches as a separate section. It's a fascinating area, again, and I will return to that. If you're not satisfied, please ask again. But we're going to spend about a whole lesson on that, and I'll go back to Thucydides and other authors in terms of the speech question. So the salvation historical character, that's something I would like for you to reflect on, the relationship between history and salvation. History namely means life, real life. And salvation means real salvation. And that connection is so significant in the book of Acts. Obviously, there are other theological characteristics that we can see and trace. Acts 1:8 is certainly a very important theological statement that fits into what we have seen about the purpose statement of the internal and external growth despite tension and opposition. Namely, that here we see this geographic concentric expansion of the message going out into the world. So, what we see here is in Acts 1:8 and borne out in the rest of the narrative is that there is a deep concern of God that this witness would go out and that it would capture not only Palestinian Jews, not only diaspora Jews, but Gentiles. Not only God-fearing Gentiles, not only people who may be proselytes, but people who are religious in Asia Minor and people who are fairly religious in Greece, Athens in particular, and into the courts in Rome. So there is this expansion, mission expansion, that is certainly a characteristic sub-theme of the book of Acts. Another element that I would like to mention under general theological characteristics is the inclusion of the Gentiles. This is a major theme that is addressed in the book of Acts, and might I add, in Luke Acts, really. I am fascinated by these wonderful passages in Isaiah 42 and 49, where God speaks about his eternal purpose to be a light to the Gentiles, that the message would be a light to the Gentiles, and as the quotation that I gave you from Simeon in Luke 2 refers to, that Jesus is the light to the Gentiles. You see, while God chose Israel as a demonstration of his covenantal love, he purposes for that mercy and that grace to go way beyond the confines of the Jewish people. That expansion of God's vision happens in the book of Acts in a major way, and in an amazing way. Because, you see, human nature has it, and I don't know if you see that in your churches at all, to become party acquainted and party concerned, and to become ingrown, and to say, look, we are Jewish people, and the other ones are the other ones. We are such and such, and the other ones are the other ones. You start beginning to build your island, and you lose sight of the fact that God calls you and calls the Jewish people to reach out. And so the book of Acts is an amazing description of how God's Spirit, sent by Christ, is moving the disciples to break through these century-old barriers and to recover the final purposes of God, which are Gentile inclusive. It is amazing how much space, I'm going to say it quickly, how much space Luke wastes, quote-unquote, to describe the enormous change that Peter has to undergo in speaking to Gentiles. Two chapters, can you believe it? And it is an amazing literary style. Chapter 10 describes what happens to Peter, and chapter 11 repeats it in Peter's own words. Same story. Over again. And then I did that, and then this happened, and then I saw this, and don't you get it? And so it is nearly like slow motion. The movie slows down, and chapter 10 and 11 goes in spelling the alphabet speed through this process of recovering God's purposes, which are for the Gentiles. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing how that is being described? Just to make sure you get the point of how significant that is, breaking through this barrier. And I'm really compelled in my own heart as there is discussion and concern about racial reconciliation in the United States among various churches, among various ethnic groups and socioeconomic groups. That's peanuts compared to what's happening there in terms of breaking out. But it is the same thing that we are asked at this point to come to, namely to see that God's purposes are not exclusive, they're inclusive. Not in the sense of the religious tolerance teaching, but in the sense of finding fellowship, Christian fellowship, across ethnic, socioeconomic, cultural, political lines, and to be bold in cutting across those lines very purposefully, so that that power that is demonstrated here with the gospel breaking out to the Gentiles is continued and manifested in our days as well. So I think there's a lot of work that we need to do in seeing how we have succumbed to certain barriers that are not the gospel lines at all. So I'm not advocating a gospel of tolerance and everything is good and let's just hold hands and be brothers and sisters. No. But where God is establishing his people, it cuts across all those lines powerfully, amazingly. And I'm, for one, to indict myself to be kind of shy and to kind of too respect too much those lines of division rather than to say no. That's where the fellowship, Christian fellowship, has to cut across and be manifest.
Thanks for listening to this Worldwide Classroom lecture from Covenant Theological Seminary. Find more Christ-centered teaching, plus interviews and devotionals at livingchrist360.com.